Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another episode of the Footmarks podcast on Combox, where the game lives on. It does not die. It is immortal. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And the title for this particular episode of the Footmarks podcast is 2025 Rewind. Jared, 2024 was a crazy year. 2025, not so much, but we still enjoyed it.
I think 2025 was a normal year. It was fine. Did we do a rewind at the end of 2024?
I think
we probably just did test cricket. It was so ridiculous.
Yeah, it was very ridiculous. I'm pretty sure we talked about that, but we've never really done a rewind. This is a first of its kind.
There we go. But yeah, no, a very normal year of international cricket, but still a lot going on. I mean, from here until test cricket is slowly strangled, or international cricket, I should say, is slowly strangled, it will be... There'll be a lot going on every year, won't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is one abnormal thing that did happen this year. South Africa won the World Test Championship, their first major ICC trophy since winning the inaugural Champions Trophy, which no one counts anyway. So first proper ICC trophy. It was great fun. They chased down 280-odd at Lord's. Demba had songs made on him. The whole world rejoiced. And then when everyone was like, oh, they had a favorable draw, this, that, the other, they played four test matches in Asia, Jared, two against Pakistan and two against India. In Pakistan, they lost one and they won the other one. And they swept India in their own backyard, which honestly made headlines. And that reaffirmed, you know, everyone who believed in South Africa that this is one of the best teams currently going on in world cricket. I mean, that is really something. The fact that they defeat Australia in the final of all teams, you know, that's a side that has haunted them in the past. And, you know, it's a giant monkey off of South Africa's back. I feel like they would be the happiest of all sides in 2025 because what they've achieved is definitely remarkable.
Yeah, I think this is probably the year that's what we're going to remember, right? I mean, even if you look at the last couple of years of them making the final in the T20 World Cup as well, and obviously the women and their success, near success, whatever, however you want to put it as well.
Almost success.
Yeah, you know, certainly something is going on in South African cricket, and it wasn't that long ago, you know, it was the last person to leave, please turn off the lights, right? Like it looked like it was done. So to go from where they were to where they are now, I think is huge. Everyone's loving the SA20 again as well. But yeah, I think they, not just winning the World Test Championship, which was massive, but then going on that run afterwards, but also beating Australia and in a chase, right? Yeah. Like in something that could have gone easily wrong. And if it had have gone wrong, no one would have been like, oh, they were chokers again. It would have been like, that's a tricky chase and these things happen, I think. So yeah, I think that's probably the biggest news story of the year. And probably over the last couple of years, South Africa is the biggest story in cricket, right? Like as in the biggest mover in cricket, maybe is the best way of putting it.
It's naive of you to assume that people wouldn't have called them chokers because people just do that anyway.
You're right.
Yeah.
The minute I said that, I was like, yeah. I mean, people who can actually understand cricket, hopefully wouldn't have called them jokers.
Yeah, but anyway, their test exploits, the Proteas, they have to be at number one with respect to all the fun stuff that happened in 2025. And, you know, it was a really nice moment in the sense that the entire cricketing globe, maybe not Australians, but everyone else, was really with them sharing that happiness because it meant something. And then Themba Bavuma, what a story, right? South Africa's first black captain, right, in test cricket. He's still unbeaten in the format, by the way, because he wasn't captain Pakistan in that loss or during that loss in Pakistan. And then you've got so many other stories, right? Simon Harmer is another interesting one. He got the ball to like turn 5 degrees and more or close to that, you know, sort of region in India. He was brilliant in Pakistan as well.
Aidan Markram redemption.
Aidan Markram, finally. Yeah. You know, that one innings that he scores every year, it came in a chase in the fourth innings of a World Test Championship final. That was brilliant. Rabada was good. Janssen really did well, especially in India. I mean, they've unearthed some superstars over here. And what I really find fascinating about South Africa's team is that they are kind of a sum of their parts. A really good team at taking 20 wickets, but also still a flawed team. It's still a fragile batting lineup if you look at it on paper.
But you say they've got some superstars, and obviously Rabada and Janssen are there. But they don't really have many superstars. What they have is incredible depth and role players. And as you said, there's still a little bit of fragility there, although it's been a while since anyone's shown that fragility back to them.
Yeah.
But there is a, you know, it's just a, the backups of their backups are really good. Like Dane Peets is what, their third best spinner? And if he came back in now, he'd be fine, right? Like there would be no issue. Like they've got lots of good players in multiple positions. They've got, you know, other wicket-keeping options and other opening bowling options and all these different things. And guys like Gerald Kotsia and Anrik Nokia haven't really done much for them of recent times. Yeah. And they're both fantastic cricketers. So there's a lot going on when it comes to the men's team. And then, you know, I know this happened this year, but, you know, we saw de Klerk the other day win another game that was what they needed, 18 off four balls or something ridiculous. And she went 6-4, 6-4, which I thought was a tennis score until I saw it. But, you know, and we've seen the women as well. They're unearthing players, that understand what they need to do, you know, really good role definition. And everyone seems to be rowing in the right direction. And a couple of years ago, they had Quinton de Kock captain, and he didn't even want to captain the side. Like, that's how far we've changed from where they were.
Yeah, I mean, I'll come to Nadine de Clutch in a bit, but there are two other fantastic stories that have come out of South Africa. Wiaan Mulder could have broken Brian Charles Lara's record. He chose to declare the innings because he was captain in that test as well, right? 367, not out. And then Shukri Conrad is another big part of this entire journey, right? And he has been sublime when it comes to managing his resources, and the team are really bought into his ideas and plans. Also made some interesting headlines this year. You know, is it fair to say that South Africa made their opposition grovel this year? Whoever
it may be. I don't think it's fair for anyone in cricket to use the word grovel. I think the word grovel in cricket is, I mean, we're going to have to start calling it the G word, right?
Yep.
Like it's such a slur in so many different ways. But yeah, let's leave the G word alone.
Yeah, it is ironic to me that, you know, a South African used it initially, which was Tony Greig, and of course he was a white South African, and now a South African of color has used the word. And
just on that, like when he says really it, weird. Doesn't he say like, oh, to like to quote someone else who said it? And I was like, well, if you know that Tony Greig said it, and you know how, surely you also know how badly it went, because there's no one who's ever been. Do you remember that time Tony Greig said the grovel word? We all laughed. We all had so much fun. No one's ever said that, right? It's such a weird thing to do.
Yeah, and coming from a South African of color, it's even weirder. But anyway, he knew what he was doing, and he was apologetic afterwards. Even as, you know, players, they mentioned that he could have chosen a better word. So let's cancel the G word once and for all. Let's leave it in 2025, guys. We don't need to go there anymore. But congratulations to South Africa for what was a marquee year. And I'm sure all Proteas fans will, you know, really look back at 2025 with fond memories. Another country which had a solid year was obviously India. And I know they've won a fair few trophies this year, but the one that really sticks out to me is the Women's ODI World Cup. India's team had never won any silverware in women's cricket. And this was a home World Cup in which, Jared, they lost some games. And all of a sudden, people were talking about whether or not they're going to qualify for the semifinals. Come semifinals, they down Australia. And Jemmy Rodrigues is the star of the show. And the final was even weirder, right? Like, you had Shefali Verma turning up and taking wickets, scoring some quick runs as well. A lot of people pitched in, and I feel like this was a moment. It could be an inflection point when we look back at it in the future, because women's cricket could really blow up from here. You're seeing the crowds of the WPL and how, you know, that particular league has exploded. Mm. Well, I feel like maybe a watershed moment has occurred in women's cricket, because India have won the ODI World Cup, that too on home soil. And I mean, it's a campaign that everyone will remember, because India were just phenomenal. And they showed a lot of character coming back the way they did, especially when guys like Boria were calling them disgusting, was it?
Was he?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. It might end up being the biggest. I know the South African story is obviously probably the place to start, but this might end up being the most important story. There's a women's basketballer from Australia called Liz Cambage, who's like 6'5", 6'6", incredible athlete, very good player, very skillful. And she runs an OnlyFans page while being a WNBA player, right? And she makes more money from OnlyFans than she does the WNBA. There's a real issue with women's sport that these people are really famous, but they're not making the money off their performances at the moment, because there's kind of... It's the last couple of years when all the money has started to come in, and it hasn't always gone to the players. And my point being with mentioning a story like that is that the thing that can supersize women's cricket more than anything else is India being consistently a finalist. They don't have to win every tournament, but they have to be in the conversation. And yes, I don't know what Borea said. I wasn't following him, of course. But the fact that people are slagging them off, I know this is going to sound wrong, but is a good thing, right? Yeah. Because they slag off the men. You don't want them to be like, well, you know, you got to understand that, you know, it's women's cricket and whatever. You want them actually to feel that same passion. You don't want this if you're a women's player because, like, you get abused and you're not used to it. But you actually want it from the perspective of you want it to mean as much. And I think I've told this story before, but in the 2009 T20 World Cup, when I went to watch the women, I'd always grown up around women's cricket. There was lots of women's cricket where I grew up, and I'd coach some women's cricket occasionally at my old club. We had a team, and I would try and help out there where I could. And so I was used to women's cricket, but I didn't watch a lot of it on TV because it was never on TV, right? Yep. So I hadn't seen as much of it. And I was at that World Cup, and I remember Claire Taylor absolutely destroyed Australia in that semi-final and won it. And I was furious with what Australia did in the field, how they set their fields, how they let Claire, I'm trying to think who she was batting with. It might've been Morgan that she was batting with, but like they just kept stuffing up. And I remember I was furious. And then afterwards I went back and I went, oh, this means I care though, right? Like that's a good thing. So it's good that they got abused. It's not good that they get abused, but but it's also incredible that they've won. And, you know, the Harmanpreet game a couple of years ago changed things. Mm. The point being is when this happens, you could be a women's cricketer in Uganda or Kenya or whatever. There's probably going to be some sort of trickle-down effect that is going to come down, right? Mm. That is going to actually change because there's so much money coming into the women's game now. And some of that will end up, there will be more. You know, I mean, I know that there's a fair break tournament in Saudi Arabia or something at the moment, but there's going to be more independent tournaments. There's going to be more tournaments. There's going to be more money in them and everything else. This is a good thing for women's cricket, but it's also great for the women involved, right? You know, the historical women who have kept Indian cricket afloat.
Yep.
And also the modern team who have professionalized it and are a pretty young side, right?
Very young side. And I mean, they were kind enough to invite all of those legends and all of them celebrated together, right? Julian Goswami was there, Mithali Raj was there, and it was lovely to see. And, you know, I feel like, you know, so much money has been pumped into Indians women cricket recently. And a lot of people were like, oh, why can't we criticize them because the men cop a lot of flack? But there's another side to this. There's another angle, which I'd like to kind of bring up. It's recent. It's not like money has been been pumped into Indians women cricket historically. And if anything, the results have been instant over here. So that criticism kind of falls on deaf ears, at least for me. And that's what I was saying or echoing throughout this ODI World Cup, that why are we pretending like they've failed for like 15 years, whereas the WPL is not even that old? So what I genuinely feel.
And the WPL's not even a fully fledged league yet. Let's be honest. It's, you know, so the fact, and I think I did a video on this at the time, they kind of jumped the queue with this win. It probably wasn't their time. There were probably other teams that were more experienced and ready, and they found a way to win out of nowhere, as you said, coming back from where they did. You know, I nothing but respect. But yeah, eventually, I don't want any cricketer abused, but you do want that same kind of passion on the men's side as you do on the women's side.
Yeah.
And I think we saw with RCB, I think we've seen it here. I think we've seen it with the treatment of the England women's side when they've been struggling over the last couple of years. The fans are starting to go, well, wait a minute. Okay.
I mean, the fans, you know, and Alex Hartley, all of those guys.
But again, so the first time I covered women's cricket was 2012 properly, right? Mm. I had done interviews with players before, but I'd never really covered the games. And I know that the Australian team was really upset with the way I was writing about them. And I sort of had some words in the back. And they said, you can't be writing this. And they were going through some of the things you were saying. And they were saying, you know, we're the professionals and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, but do you want me to write about you as if you're not very good and so everything's great? Or do you want me to write about you the same way I would write about men's cricket? And there's a long pause. At that point, not everyone agreed. Like, there were people within that conversation who were like, actually, we would prefer you to promote us more. And I was like, I'm happy to promote women's cricket, but if when I'm doing analysis of women's cricket, it's going to be analysis. And I thought your fielding placements were shit, right? And, you know, and I thought Susie Bates were much better. You guys have a better team than New Zealand, so you beat them. But that should be the conversation. It's hard because a lot of women's cricketers have no sort of external media fan expectation on them until they get to the international team or now the WPL. And suddenly everyone knows who they are, right? Mm. And so they go from 0 to 100 much more than men's cricketers quite often do. But that's the world that they're in at the moment. So, but well done to them. I thought, as I said, this might go on to be one of the most important things because we already know that, you know, the Women's Premier League is one of the highest paid leagues in the world and, you know, one of the fastest growing women's sports leagues in the world. What will this do to it? And what will the next 4 or 5 years of this incredibly talented younger side do to it?
Absolutely. I mean, it could be, you know, that sort of a watershed moment that men's cricket saw with the 2007 T20 World Cup, the inaugural edition. And I feel like, you know, things could really change for women's cricket here on. More money will be pumped into it. The fanfare has definitely increased. This was the most watched ODI World Cup for women ever as well. So, you know, casuals, like I was a casual when it came to women's cricket, but I was like fully hooked and I knew of all the arcs and I'd done my homework and I wanted to cover this event. So
the tournament got a little bit rain affected, didn't it, for a little while where it was that was probably its biggest issue. But other than that, I mean, it's and look, you're going to get that. We're probably about to get that with the Men's World Cup coming up as well. But
yeah, fingers crossed over there. The Sri Lankan legs of the World Cups that aren't supposed to happen in Sri Lanka, basically, right? Like those are getting washed out and here's to hoping that that doesn't happen with the T20 World Cup. But originally, the point I was trying to make is that we cannot undermine India's women's feat that they have achieved over here. But also, you know, before we move on to the next thing, South Africa, let's not undermine their feat as well. They were phenomenal. They actually defeated India in the group stages. That's where Nadine de Klerk went crazy. And she continued to just smash clutch runs over and over and over again. And then Laura Wolvart, in both those knockouts games, she scored tons. She's the one who kind of downs England, right? When she just plays one of the best knocks that we've ever seen in women's cricket. I feel like that's another team that is headed in the right direction. We saw, originally I saw South Africa lack depth when it came to quality, but their overall batting and bowling depth really helped them. And we got unlikely heroes as well, like Chloe Tryon, who I never rated before this ODI World Cup, for instance, right? I was like, okay, she seems to be quite handy. And sure, they might be a bit top heavy in the sense that if their batters don't click in women's ODIs or, you know, women's cricket in general, they might struggle. But I feel like that is a big, big story as well. They might not have won the ODI World Cup, but they were undoubtedly the second best team.
No doubt. And I like it. They've got a team with multiple options. Again, it's a bit like the men's team. There's a couple of, you know, there's a Marazan Cap in there, right? And there's the Wolf. But, you know, and Nadine de Klerk may become a sort of, you know, Lance Klusener type figure for that team, the way that she's going at the moment. But there, you know, there aren't that many stars, but there's a lot of people who know their roles and are very good at what they do, and they seem to have backups when they need them. So, yeah, it's, again, a very impressive thing. They probably let themselves down a little bit in the final. I think I think by the time we go to the final, I think India were the favourite, but South Africa had probably been the better team in the tournament.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And, I mean, I think in one of your pieces, you called Nadine de Klerk the queen of the wet ball. Right. And that's kind of what she was in that World Cup. And her stock continues to rise. As you said, she chased down, 18 runs in the last 4 deliveries in the WPL. And she's going to be earning a lot of money now. So good stuff all around. I feel like South Africans should be really, really happy with their 2025. As should Indians, of course. And there's more on India. But before that, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching Footmarks with Behram and Jared. And go nowhere because we'll be back in like half a minute.
I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things, the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny SIMs and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
Welcome back to the Footmarks podcast. You guys are with Jared and Behram, and we are going over all of the cricketing stories or major cricketing stories of 2025. It is 2025 Rewind. And speaking of India, which was the team that we were discussing, we spoke about, you know, the achievements of the women's team and how they were crowned world champions for the very first time in their history. Well, the men's team also won some silverware. They won the Champions Trophy. They won the Asia Cup. Both of those, you know, tournaments were held in the UAE. And weirdly enough, India didn't play their best cricket in those tournaments. They brought out their B game or C game. And yes, conditions favored them. In one of those tournaments, the Champions Trophy, there was no travel fatigue because they were situated in the UAE through and through, in Dubai, in fact. But then again, they were the best team. They made use of those conditions and they showed the gulf between them and the rest when, you know, they weren't particularly on top of their game and still they won those tournaments quite comfortably. I mean, take the final of the Asia Cup out and that Sri Lanka game. Every other game was kind of a walkover for India. And in the Champions Trophy, I don't think anyone challenged them. Like, no one particularly came close. And they didn't light the world on fire either. Like, Abhishek Sharma is one guy who you could say definitely lit the world on fire. And he became a story. And everyone's going to be talking about him heading into 2026 and that World Cup. But you expect this from the men's team? Easy stuff in the Champions Trophy and then the Asia Cup. Well, that's probably going to be remembered for far worse reasons than the actual cricket.
The funny thing is that you list off all that and then you're like, who's the coach most likely to be fired at the moment? It's probably Brendan McCullum. And who's the coach second most likely to be fired? It's probably Gautam Gambhir. So it tells you, A, the expectations on the men's team. I know that a lot of that is also to do with the test series and not just the limited overs. But yeah, their white ball side looks ridiculous and their red ball side looks like it's in transition. So there's two different Indian men's teams out there at the moment.
Yeah.
They're going to start the T20 World Cup as very, very short favorites and they absolutely deserve to be very, very short favorites, I think, as well. But yeah, you're right. I also don't think they've played their best cricket all that often. So it'd be interesting to see if they can pull that together for a World Cup, because I don't think anyone can get close to them if they do that, or if they slip and there's another team that can sort of come from nowhere.
Yeah, I feel Australia is the team that probably comes closest in terms of challenging India in the upcoming T20 World Cup. Of course, it's a volatile format. Anything can happen. But conventional wisdom suggests that it's those two teams which are front runners, and India would be ahead of Australia in terms of that favourites tag. However, you know, you expect them to win these trophies. The Champions Trophy was kind of within their ballpark in the sense that they had that ODI team from the 2023 ODI World Cup, and that's the one that got away. That's the one that probably stings most for Indian fans. So this victory, especially, you know, in a tournament where we got to see Virat Kohli score runs again, this, that, the other, without Jasprit Bumrah in, you know, the Champions Trophy at least, that must have felt special. Donning those white coats is probably the best part of winning the Champions Trophy. But the Asia Cup was interesting. It was a toxic shithole, is what it was. Having covered it for multiple platforms, I did not enjoy it in the sense that the cricket was secondary and all of the political nonsense was front and center. And that does leave a bit of a sour taste because you want Asian cricket to be in harmony and it's such a big cash cow that you feel that why wouldn't people work together to, you know, put their best foot forward and deliver quality product? But unfortunately, they made mad money for all the wrong reasons because tempers were flaring. The two countries were at war earlier in 2025 and the Asia Cup kind of just like it unfolded in a very, very ugly manner. And I hope that we also leave that bit in 2025. No more drama in 2026, please. Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, I mean, there are some Bangladesh fans with their hands up at the moment going, excuse me. But yeah, look, it's the Asia Cup is what it is. It's probably the first Asia Cup I really watched all the way through. So maybe that's a win. I don't know. One extra white dude watching it. I don't know if that's what the audience is. But it's fascinating to me how much the other Asian teams have slipped. And that's the next big one. I was just looking at the World Cup odds. So this is a World Cup in Asia, and you have India as almost unbackable favourites.
Yeah.
Then Australia, South Africa, and England are all around 4 and 5 to 1. Pakistan is 14 to 1. Sri Lanka is 40 to 1. Bangladesh is 125 to 1. Although who knows what's going on there? Where's Afghanistan? Oh, 22 to 1.
Okay.
You know, we don't really 14 to 1 is not a realistic chance of winning the title. I'm not saying they won't, Pakistan, but the bookies are saying they won't. And so you think, you know, it's interesting. It's not just the power on the field, right? It's the power off the field. And that was probably another year of, as we said, it was a sort of a nonsensical tournament in many different ways that India didn't always play, that weren't probably playing their best cricket and they still won. I don't know.
That Asia Cup final, India played terrible cricket, but Pakistan were like, hold up a second, we'll outdo you in terms of terrible cricket. And, you know, they lost the crunch moments. And even though it was one hell of a final, it was an absolute spectacle. But Yeah, I mean, it's a part of 2025 that I'd like to forget because, you know, if you are from India or Pakistan, that's a very kind of tumultuous period on social media, for instance, because people from both sides went hammer and tongs.
And in real life.
Yeah. I mean, even the boards went a bit crazy over there. No handshakes became a thing in different contexts for India. In this,
was 2025 the year of no handshakes?
It has to be, right? Whether you're asking for a draw or you are just trying to show sportsman spirit. India and Gautam Gambhir's India in particular are not fans of handshakes. That much is evident from 2025. But Gambhir had this moment after losing the two-match test series to South Africa 2-0. He started counting the things that he has achieved, where he stated that, oh, I've won the Champions Trophy. I've won the Asia Cup. I drew 2-2 in England, which was also a really crazy series, and we'll get to that. And here we are thinking, you know, if he doesn't win the T20 World Cup, he's probably on his way out.
I think it's really fascinating, and it tells you how the expectations on the Indian side are so ridiculous at the moment. I'm not saying I wouldn't have hired him in the first place and there aren't issues and everything else, but it's so hard at the moment to run that side, and he's certainly struggling as much as anyone would be, right? It's just that kind of thing. But there's a very good Sid Monga article about Gautam Gambhir. And I was in the middle of writing one as well, which will probably come up in the next couple of weeks. I think there's some interesting questions to be asked about not just him, but also what we expect from a coach. Like, you could make a similar argument for like the Australian women's coach of like, they can't win every single tournament, can they? They do have to lose some things.
Yeah. And I mean, I wonder to myself, what if Gautam Gambhir ran Combox? Would he have only left and right pairings for podcasts? That would be quite fascinating. Only all rounders. If you're only good at one skill, we won't hire you. Right?
Like I say, you have to write and podcast, surely.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, that's a developing story anyway. And for all you know, India will win the T20 World Cup and this will be nipped in the bud. But the test team has slipped, as you mentioned. The England series was fascinating in the sense that both sides were flawed and they were flat decks, and we ended up with 2-2, largely thanks to Mohammad Siraj. But I personally feel that result is despite Gambhir's coaching. That's just because some people played really, really good cricket. I don't think the tactics won India that, or drew, helped India draw that series. It's interesting because the test team is in decline, or not in decline, but you could say it is under a period of transformation, right? That's fair. Or transition, rather. And yeah, I mean, how do you fix it?
Yeah. Do you know the thing about the 2-2? And I've been thinking about this a lot in the last couple of weeks, isn't it worse now?
I mean, yeah, both sides were shit, right?
Because now India went and lost to South Africa and England went and lost to Australia. They now look like by far and away the two best sides, and India and England look a decent step behind, right? So I don't even know how to process the 2-2 anymore because, you know, the context around it has changed quite a bit. So yeah, I think India are coming into a really interesting period where they might only have success in one or two formats and not all three as they wish. And it'd be interesting to see how that is handled because it's not how other sports work, right?
And I mean,
this not how things go.
If you think about it, they had some big retirements, right? Ravi Ashwin or Ravi Chandran Ashwin. Virat Kohli, Rohit Sharma, and they didn't have ready-made replacements as such, and then Gautam Gambhir went gung-ho on all-rounders. I feel like this is going to take a bit more transition, right? Because now they're losing at home. They've lost 5 test matches at home in the last 15 months, I want to say, if my math is correct. So there's no easy fix over here. They might need a change of coach at some point, and they're not playing test cricket till the summer. So in tests, I suppose India only have that one series, the Anderson Tendulkar Trophy, which also sparked debate of whether it should be called that or not, right? But it was fun to watch. At least we can give it that. Siraj's spell, we'll remember that. Ben Duckett, Joe Root, Shubman Gill, Rishabh Pant, lots of good batting performances. Ben Stokes taking all those wickets.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, England, of course, and I know I'm kind of skipping all the way through to November, December, but the Ashes was a bloodbath. We built up to it for all these years. England were overprepared, right? As per Brendan McCullum.
That was the problem.
Misread the conditions, picked the wrong bowling attack, didn't play the correct teams, and just made some terrible decisions. Couldn't bat better than Australia, couldn't bowl better than them, and they definitely could not outfield or outthink them. We've done an entire Ashes podcast on Footmark, so you don't need to go into details, but yeah, a bit of a damp squib.
Yeah, it's a shame because there really isn't that much between these two sides, especially when you factor in how many injuries Australia had.
Yeah.
If Australia's bowling attack was fully fit and this happened, I'd be like, that's fair.
True.
It really shouldn't be happening when Cummins, Lyon and Hazelwood bowl less than 100 overs, right, in the series. So, yeah, it is poor, and it was an ordinary way to finish. And England really let themselves down. The bubble well and truly burst. And now the fascinating thing is to see what happens next, right? Like, what is left of this Baseballian era, and who gets the blame? Is anyone going to lose their jobs? Like, there's definitely some conversations to be had in the next little while.
I mean, 2025 did not go to plan at all for baseball. And, you know, like, I feel like there's still a lot of merit to the approach and they could still make it work. But right now they're going to have to do some soul searching, and they'd probably want to forget this past year. I mean, the result versus India wasn't all too bad, but England would be disappointed that they didn't win that last test match. The Oval Test was there for the taking for them as well. Wokesy gets injured, lots of stuff happens. But I mean, I still feel that this can be a good test team if they just rejig a few good things, but the issue is that the pipeline doesn't look all too good, and it's not like talent is coming in. So that's probably England's biggest worry, even apart from, you know, the tactics.
Even if you, I just did a podcast today with John Norman and Steve Harmison. It's like, even if you rejig it, it's still basically the same bowling attack.
Yeah.
Right. With Liam Dawson in ahead of, you know, Will Jacks or Shoaib Bashir. It's not an inspiring team at the moment. But I think something's going to have to change. The tactics, and we've been talking about this since day one, the tactics of baseball is fantastic. No one has any issues with that. When you use the tactics, yes. If that's the only tactic you ever use, also yes.
Yep. I mean, let's see whether they recover or not. They've got like 5 test matches at home, 3 against Pakistan and 2, I want to say Sri Lanka, but I don't remember anymore. It's tough to remember what the FTP looks like, but we'll see what baseball or the baseballers have in store.
They play New Zealand and Pakistan, don't they?
Okay, yeah, New Zealand it is, not Sri Lanka, yeah. But yeah. So if there is some sort of a rejuvenation, whether baseball lives or it continues to die even further, we shall find out. We also have no idea what that team or management would look like either. I mean, Rob Key, Brendan
McCullum.
That's
what I mean. I think that's the... What kind of cricket are they going to play?
Yeah.
Right? Everything's on the table now.
That is the million-dollar question. And speaking of test cricket, and this probably is the last bit that I want to mention, Zimbabwe played 10 test matches this year, Jared. It is a marquee year for them as well. And it was really weird or kind of... fascinating that a team which doesn't even compete in the World Test Championship, and you know, the Zimbabwean cricket board isn't particularly rich compared to some of the other ones, they have managed to schedule 10 test matches in a calendar year, something that countries like South Africa, Pakistan and New Zealand are so far off from. Now, they only managed to win 2 of them and lose 8, but I suppose this definitely deserves a mention.
No, it does. I think, you know, someone said to me, you know, what's the difference? And I think one of the key differences is we're far enough removed from Robert Mugabe and his people involved with running Zimbabwe and Zimbabwean cricket. Robert Mugabe was very actively involved in cricket. Peter Jingoka was one of the most important people. Before the Indian takeover and the Big Three takeover that led to the sort of the BCCI takeover, ICC, Peter Jingoka was like the most important person because he was a swing vote between all these different factions all the time. And Peter Jingoka, it'd be fair to say, was doing what he thought was best for him and Zimbabwean cricket, right? I don't think he was, you know, I'm not saying he wasn't a cricket fan, but I think it's fair to say he was doing what he thought was best. And it feels like over the last couple of years, slowly but surely, we're seeing something that where Zimbabwean cricket is being run for Zimbabwean cricket's sake a little bit more. And this year was probably a perfect example of that. As you said, it's fascinating that they did this. I heard some chat that they realized that the streaming numbers would be quite good so they could get some sponsors. You know, there's low overheads when you play games in Zimbabwe. Quite a few of those games were in Zimbabwe. They cashed in some favors, I think, from some nations as well. Absolutely fantastic. They've got some really good cricketers. They, you know, have some, they don't have a full strength team and, you know, they have some issues as well, but there's some, you know, good players in there, you know, Bennett and Blessing and some of these guys, not to mention some of the older fellas as well. Shout out to our man Sikander, but yeah. you know, they are that they started the year quite well. I think they had three tests where they had three chances to win. They only won one of them. Then they got smashed by an innings quite a bit, I think, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, they're the team that conceded the Wiyan Mulder unbeaten 367, of course. New Zealand smashed them as well. England smashed them at Trent Bridge. The Sam Cook test, as we like to remember it, right? And yeah, I mean, look, I'm all for other countries trying to follow the Zimbabwe model. I'd love to know what the profit and loss ratios were like, because 10 tests or scheduling 10 tests requires a fair bit of investment. But Zimbabwe have shown it to the rest of the world that you can't always kind of cry wolf with respect to test cricket. If you really want to play more test cricket, it's possible. And maybe...
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they could do it consistently and whether it was financially viable and everything else. But they kind of needed a comeback year, didn't they? Where just to let everyone know they still play cricket, they've still got some talent there. And both things are true.
Mm. And, you know, countries like Sri Lanka, Pakistan, New Zealand, South Africa, if they want to, they can schedule test matches outside the FTP and maybe send their second string sides to play Ireland, to play Afghanistan, to play Zimbabwe. It's possible.
Also, a lot of teams will say it's so expensive to play test cricket. And I was like, well, it is if you play at a major venue and you add on it, you can slim it down. The ICC have talked about this before, about like, it doesn't always have to, like, as long as the conditions are fine, right? Like it doesn't always have to be at the biggest ground of all time. Like Ireland play at Malahide, right? Yeah. There are ways of doing this. And I do think it sometimes there's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses from some of the middling teams where they're like, oh, we have to, and it's like, do you, New Zealand play cricket in a park? I just think that, We can sometimes limit the way that we think about things.
Yeah, and you know, West Indies is another team which could probably look into this. They've got some promise in their test team all of a sudden. First, we were saying they cannot bat, and they save a test match by batting for 2 days. That also happens at the end of 2025. And it's funny, like every single calendar year, there's that one test match in which West Indies will do something that they'll end up on a rewind show.
And, I mean, it's true. It is true. They do one thing and then, you know, well, is this them? No, it's not. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't quite winning the test match at the Gabba versus Australia. A pink ball test at that. The only side which have ever defeated Australia in a pink ball test, mind you, which is definitely a feat. But yeah, I mean, look, I feel like given the fact that test cricket is only financially viable for the very, very strong boards, if we start to see an uptick in the number of test matches, maybe there can be a bit of a revival for the other teams as well. And we'll have to, again, look at the numbers for this and whether or not this was a financial success. But I love the fact that Zimbabwe played 10 test matches. And then, what was his name? The West Indian batter who batted for all that while? Not Shea Hope, Justin Graves. Last year, it was, Shamar Joseph's stock kind of really nosedived in 2025. But, I mean, Justin Graves is the new name.
Not a good year for him.
Not a good year for him at all. And, we always love a bit of resistance. And I feel like everyone deep down in their hearts wants West Indies cricket to do well. So we got a bit of that as well. Okay.
No, definitely.
Lots more to discuss. But before that, we shall be taking another short break. You guys are watching Footmarks with Jared and Behram. Go nowhere. We'll be back in half a minute.
Ross Taylor couldn't see. At night, or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Welcome back to the Footmarks podcast. You guys are with Jared and Behram, and we are going over all the major cricketing stories from 2025 in a rewind show. Now, let's shift our focus a bit to franchise T20 cricket. Of course, lots and lots of leagues have proliferated the market and the calendar, but this was a big IPL year, and that's because RCB finally won the goddamn title. Virat Kohli got his moment under the sun. Chris Gayle and AB de Villiers were also over there celebrating with the team. And I mean, I feel like this was very, very special because that fan base, the Bangalore or Bengaluru fan base, is one of the most passionate in the world when it comes to franchise T20s. And I mean, no one was giving them much of a shot at the start of the IPL. Then they kind of go on a run and win it in a magnificent fashion. I feel like that's definitely a story and one that at least IPL fans will never forget.
No, it was huge, wasn't it? I think... Like, I always knew that RCB fans were I'm not sure what the right, more passionate than maybe some of the other fan bases, or more organized. I don't even know how you would say, but there was always something about them. As someone who's covered the IPL since the first year, it was always very clear. But when they won the women's tournament and you saw that they were just as excited for the women, I was just like, okay, I kind of hope that they get one now just so that the fans have something. Sadly, of course, it ends up in a horrendous circumstances with what happened at that stadium. And I hope the people who are guilty for that, you know, are certainly brought to justice. It seems like just a bunch of errors compounded on top of each other. But yeah, that I think the fan base and the group really deserved that victory. And so, you know, from my perspective, I'm kind of happy that they finally got one. And, you know, it's also one of those things of we can all... You know, there are many of us who are like T20 devotees who can argue about Virat Kohli as a player and everything else.
Yeah.
None of us would ever say he's not good enough to have won an IPL title, though. That's a ridiculous thing to think. Yeah. And so he kind of did, as you said, he needed one. And you have these kinds of, this is the sort of thing that will help in conversations in 10, 15, 20 years' time. Whereas if he hadn't won one, then you become Charles Barkley, right? And, you know, you become the footballer who doesn't win the proper medal and everyone sort of looks at you a bit weirdly, despite the fact that it's a team sport and it isn't always your fault.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with respect to Virat Kohli's legacy, this was a really important milestone or, you know, checkbox to kind of tick off. The only thing that kind of or definitely will haunt him is not having lifted the test mace after a World Test Championship final. But then he retires this year from the format. But it doesn't matter because you cannot possibly win everything. And I know how much it meant to him personally to have won a title for RCB. That fan base deserved it. They had waited for it for so long. Of course, the stampede is something that no one would like to remember. And thoughts and prayers go out to the victims and for whoever kind of was on the wrong end of it. And I mean, I saw a lot of people holding, you know, the local organizers and government and sort of stuff accountable. And that should happen. But, you know, they have now become the royal champions of Bengaluru, not just the royal challengers. And with that major monkey off their back, I feel like whatever cricket they'll play here on, it will kind of come with fresh perspective because the big thing's done. Now it's about building, you know, a legacy for the future. And no one can say that, oh, they've never won an IPL title, even though they have been one of the best teams in so many of these tournaments. So that's one big thing that's happened for them. And I'm really happy for them. And now let's move towards some associate cricket. There was a major story, Jared, with respect to T20 World Cup qualification. Italy are not going to be featuring in the FIFA World Cup in 2026, but they will be playing the T20 World Cup for the very first time, courtesy of some of the Australian stars and Joe Burns and the Menenti brothers. And I mean, Emilio Gay, I don't know who wants to claim him, the West Indies or England, but he was...
Everyone wants to claim him at the moment by the sound of it.
Yeah, but you know, they had some of these guys who were playing regular, you know, domestic cricket in other countries, and some of these ex-Australian stars like Joe Burns, who weirdly enough is now not part of the team. I don't know if you followed that story, but he had issues with the administrators and now Joe Burns is sacked prior to the T20 World Cup. That's a bit annoying for me.
Yeah, it's not ideal, is it? We've seen this before. Ryan Tendulkar, who's now India's assistant coach or batting fielding coach. I don't even know what kind of... Well, I don't actually know what his role is, but one of their coaches. I remember there was a period of time where he didn't play for the Dutch. And what he'd asked for was like quite simple. He was like, if I'm going to be flying around, like I'm getting older, my body's not holding up, can I get business class? Mm. And the Dutch went, no one gets special treatment. And he's like, look, guys, I'm playing in the IPL. I'm just asking for, you know, business class to sit on the plane. And it's not the only associate player who has not decided to play for an associate level for very basic things. I'm not saying Joe Burns is like that, but it could be something more simple. I kind of started to follow that story and then lost it a little bit. But look, Ireland did this. Netherlands have done this. We've seen teams be quite smart now and go, well, wait a minute. And I remember the reason I heard about this was through Jake Dernbach, who said, I was commentating with him and he's like, yeah, I've been asked to go over and play with the Italian team. He goes, there's some players. There's a lot of us who have Italian ancestry. And so I kept like one ear out. And then next thing you know, half the Big Bash is playing for them. And look, it's incredible. I think in the same year they had that story drop about the the Italian town that tried to ban cricket because they hated the Bangladeshi immigrants.
Wow.
So you know, there's a lot going on with Italian cricket over the last couple of years. We did a feature on it a little bit. We talked about Italian cricket. I grew up with a lot of guys who played cricket, whose parents were Italian, who would qualify for this kind of team. And in fact, one of them sent me a message the other day with a photo from me when I was a kid playing cricket with him. And you know, so for me, Italians playing cricket was a very normal thing. Their parents would bring them to the games, and quite often their parents would speak either, you know, very spotty English, in some cases not speak English at all, and drop their kids off to play cricket. And so these were very Italian kids, you know, with the packed lunches they had for the games and, you know, their outlook. And, that, you know, they followed Italy in the football, but they wanted to play cricket for Australia. And so, you know, it was very normal for me to grow up with that. I can imagine for a lot of other cricket fans around the world who are like, wait, what? Italy and cricket? But it also, it goes back, obviously, with AC Milan and,
yeah,
and you know, all these different things. There is a history of cricket in Italy. And I think these boards, there's a lot of European countries that could do the same thing. I made this joke recently, but like, I grew up with so many people from Croatia and Serbia. I think they'd have a pretty good team if they did a little bit of recruiting. I really think there's a bunch of European teams who could, in places like England, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, recruit quite cleverly. And some of these association teams are noticing this.
Yeah, I mean, we all know the connection between South Africa and the Dutch team. There are lots of fans which feature for both or have featured for both. Roelof van der Merwe probably now will be remembered as a Dutch player more than a South African player, right?
And I think definitely, right?
Yeah, has to be. But, you know, even if Joe Burns unfortunately won't be there representing Italy and captaining Italy in the T20 World Cup, which kind of does bum me out, we still have got Wayne Madsen, the Menenti brothers. You've got Emilio Gay, who you never know might even play test cricket for England someday, right? Like
Emilio Gay might play for every cricket team in the world. And I'm him and Acer Tribe are the two guys this year. I suppose Suryavanshi is maybe the third one, right? But you kind of expect it of a young Indian guy does incredible things in the IPL. But Acer Tribe, do you know who, when I say Acer Tribe, do you know who I'm talking about?
Of course I do. I've done many shows with Rob Barron, Jared.
Of course you have. But 3 or 4 months ago, like no one knew who Acer Tribe was. It might have been Barron or my friend Jake. One of them brought him up. And I looked into his stats and I was like, what's going on here? Emilio Gay is the other one, right?
Yeah.
These guys have come from nowhere and they are suddenly like huge and like, and I'm talking about real cricket fans are like, you've got to see these guys, right? And it's, I think, you know, it's one of the great things about this sort of global cricket coverage that we have now on the internet and everything else of like, there are people who are Acer Tribe fans, right? There are people who are Emilio Gay fans and they come, and you know, a couple of years ago, you could throw someone like Sekhunda Ruzza into that sort of thing. And these players come from nowhere and then and now they've got their own like little fan bases. It's so much fun.
It is a lot of fun. And what I'd really love to see is that considering the fact that AC Milan originally was a cricket and football club, and they've done some fun photo shoots as well with their footballers padded up and stuff like that. Stream Italy's World Cup games. Bring your fans into this. Let's make a spectacle out of it. Of course, like Italy is such a, it's a country with such a rich heritage when it comes to football. They won't be there in North America in the summer. So cash in on the T20 World Cup, guys. It only makes sense.
It would be hilarious if just like a bunch of Italians just turned up to the World Cup venues, would they? Like if they just go all in. But look, it's hopefully you hope in these countries, and we know that the Dutch are certainly is a country, and Ireland is a country that has changed their cricket future.
Yep.
Scotland are getting back to where they probably always should have been. You know, we've still got Denmark that we hope one day rekindles their love of cricket again like they used to have. You know, there are countries in Europe that have a strong cricket history, and it would be great to see. We don't need them all to be like trying to make it to the finals, but just have a cricket culture that makes sense. Because, you know, the funny thing about cricket is that because we don't have a lot of countries, every country that's ever come into cricket has given us something.
Yeah.
And that's kind of very unique because we don't have that many countries as well. So for me, it's nothing but a joyful thing. And, you know, I love the fact that we're seeing this.
I mean, one country that's probably late to the party from Europe is Greece. Give me Peter Hadzoglou captaining them in the next T20 World Cup, right?
I mean, again, you've got Peter, you've got Theo Daropoulos, who played Big Bash cricket as well. I'm just, off the top of my head, I reckon I could give you about 4 or 5 Greek players that played Shield cricket over the years, not to mention heaps in club cricket as well. Like, there legitimately is so many people out there, and that from all these different countries. I think Greece would have, there'd be a few Greek players in South Africa, I would have thought as well, because I think there's a little Greek community in there, if I remember correctly as well. So yeah, the point being is that this is the world that we live in now, right? Emilio Gay is qualified to play for every single cricket team in the world, right? Like, you know, my kids are qualified to play for like 3 different cricket teams, right? Yeah. Like that is just the world that we live in. You know, your kids will be the same. They'll have multiple teams that they can play in as well. And that's the society that we live in now. And if you're a cricket board, embrace that.
Would you be prouder of Eek if he represents Sri Lanka or Australia as opposed to England?
Big diss on Clementine's cricket there, that you didn't reach for Clementine and you went for Eek.
Has she improved?
Hey? Oh, she's playing. She played this year. She's in the under sevens.
Beautiful.
No, she loves her cricket at the moment. She keeps saying, "Why aren't we playing now?" And I said, "Look outside. How are you going to play?" No, I don't think it would matter to me. I think I remember, like you know, I've seen people whose kids have gone on to, like, I know some parents and families of people who've gone on to play for associate nations or everything else, and they're just as proud. You just want your kids to do well, right? And like, if they want to play cricket and they get to that level, it would be great. I mean, if they play for England, I have some issues, but that's...
Imagine we're doing a rewind of 2035 and Eek has won the Ashes for Australia in England, finally, ever since...
Eek is all in on Australia, by the way. Like, Eek does not support England at all. Like, it's actually really fascinating because English cricket, so many people do come with family members from different backgrounds. And I would say there's more chat about other cricket teams than the England team over the last couple of years. The 100 is quite big with younger kids in the UK, but the international team, quite often it's like India, Pakistan, Australia, New Zealand, depending on where your parents are from. And again, that's what I'm saying. That's the world that we live in, right? Like, Ben Stokes could have played for multiple teams. This is where we are going. And so I think it's fantastic that's what's happening with Italy. And if you have a problem with people from other countries going back and helping early teams, have a look at where the early Australian players and South African players were born.
Yeah, well, imagine the headline. Ezekiel Kimber, who is from Lewisham and is born there, breaks Shane Warne's record of 40 wickets in a single Ashes series in England and finally wins Australia a test series in England. That would be a headline. And I don't know, Clementine Kimber breaks Chamari Attapattu's record for Sri Lanka? Make it happen.
That's going to happen, though, isn't it? Because we already had the Pattinson brothers play for 2 different countries, right?
Yep.
Like, we are literally going to see things like that again happening. You might, you know, the Curran brothers are doing it at the moment. Right? Yeah. Like, it's ridiculous. We are going to see weird things like that happen over and over again, where 3 or 4 people from one family are going to play for 3 or 4 different teams.
Well, I would love to see it. Anyway, let's kind of end this rewind with some finance news, I would say. Some of the economics of our sport, which have been threatened, and there have been more opportunities or potential opportunities. Let's start with the potential kind of breakthrough of Saudi Arabia within cricket. We don't know in what capacity it might happen. Some people have said that they might, kind of take over the Champions League for franchise T20s. There was talk of the Saudi Slam. There were leaked reports. You know, at the start of the year, we were hearing a lot of this, and then all of a sudden, nothing towards the end of 2025. I feel like if something happens, it will be in partnership with the BCCI, because they won't challenge them. They would definitely, you know, join hands with them. But I really hope that 2026 gives us some spice with respect to Saudi Arabia coming and, I don't know, having a tournament or something.
Well, the fair break one is really interesting if they end up having a women's tournament in Saudi Arabia.
I mean, that would be great for PR, right? First you sports wash, then there's a women's cricket tournament. Lovely.
It's out there, right? if fair break was like, we're not going to take money from gambling companies because we don't want to be associated with domestic violence to women. And then they're like, but we are thinking about having a tournament in Saudi Arabia, which is a bit of a pivot morally, I think, or emotionally or politically or where however you want to go on that. I think what happens from my understanding of this is that Saudi Arabia has this incredible fund, right? Mm.
They're already sponsoring the ICC, and then they've got ties with Australia, the whole DAZN.
But with everything, right across all world sports. And the way that I understand it, and obviously I've done, you know, Chris Barrett broke the story, I think, and I've done a lot of reporting on it since, is the way I understand it is they kind of, there's a flurry of activity where the Saudis are suddenly calling everyone and being like, we want to do this and we want to do that. And everyone's like, oh, okay, yes, of course. You've got money and we will meet you and we are interested in that.
I mean, Real Madrid and Barcelona literally yesterday played a cup final in Jeddah.
Exactly. And I think that's what happens is then their attention sort of goes to the next thing, right? And so, and we've seen this over and over again. You know, we've heard lots of stories about everything's moving to Saudi Arabia, then nothing does. And then suddenly you have, as you say, a major game there and then nothing happens again. And the golf, it's all about the golf. We're going to take over World Golf. Actually, we're going to partner with World Golf, right? Like that seems to be how they're running it at the moment. And they've got so much money and they've obviously, you know, what happened to their bubble city in the desert? The big long line city that seems to be falling apart. So again,
there's a big long line city and there's a cube city. They're doing both.
Yeah. from my understanding is the big long line city is not progressing the way that they thought it was going to be and may never exist, right? And again, that makes sense because they've got all these different ideas. They got a bunch of attention, right? And then they're like, actually, it's a bit harder to do than we thought. So then they pull back. And it's the same with cricket. I think at one stage, they were like, we could buy all of cricket. And then they were like, oh, but that would cause issues with our relationships with India and some of our partnerships there.
Yep.
Let's scale that back. And I think that's how they do things, is my understanding, right? So it's not over. I have no idea what the final thing will be. And I think anyone, you know, unless it was an insider, I don't think anyone could tell you at the moment. My understanding is that they are still genuinely interested in cricket. How that will come out, let's see. But that does show you, I think, you know, for a lot of people in the West who maybe don't follow global politics and all these sorts of things, I don't think they realize just how much money there is in, you know, Middle East, Asia, you know, parts of Africa as well, that is coming. And you know, a lot of the West itself is a little bit stale and is maybe tapped out is the best way of putting it, right? Right. And, you know, there's probably a reason why Donald Trump is talking about Venezuela and Greenland, right? Like, it's trying to find resources wherever you can. And a lot of these other random countries have the resources, but not always the ability to deal with them and everything else. All these things, there is a big shift, I think, in global politics. And obviously Saudi Arabia and India, not that I'm linking those two countries, but those are the sorts of countries, UAE, that are at the forefront of this, right? And, you know, how that plays out over the next 5 years will, or 10 years, will affect cricket.
Yeah.
As much as it will affect everything else in our life.
I mean,
and so
there's already an existing link between Saudi Arabia and India, even within cricket, because the IPL auction happened there, right? So there's that. And you told me about Saudi prince who came to the World Test Championship final and he asked for the law book. And of course, you know, people who don't follow
the Ambanis
politics,
as well.
The Ambanis are also
the
Ambanis.
The Olympic Committee, there's a link, which is also through the Ambanis. I mean, there are lots of links with cricket and Saudi Arabia and lots of links between BCCI and Saudi Arabia and Indian business interests in Saudi Arabia. So you're right.
Yeah, we've seen those sponsors in cricket as well. Aramco, Visit Saudi Arabia. And it's funny how, you know, people who don't understand how global politics and that sort of stuff works, the current monarchy in Saudi Arabia is looking to diversify outside of oil and religious tourism.
Exactly.
They're going towards other kinds of tourism. And of course, sports washing is one of their main kind
sports of strategies. Sports washing, that these new buildings, as you said, the Cube City, the Line City, all these things, they are, you know, they just had that big comedy thing, right?
Dave Chappelle?
They're coming for everything. They have the money. They have worked out that they have to change what their perception, because the perception was really bad of Saudi Arabia, right? And that's what people with lots of money do. If you go back through the history, I mean, you know, we don't start every sentence now with, do you remember when England tried to enslave the world, right? Like, we don't. Things move on. Yeah. Right? We don't start every sentence with, do you remember when, you know, America were bombing Japan? Mm. Things move on and that narrative changes, and Saudi Arabia is trying to do that. Now, it's more than fine for everyone to go, yeah, but they're still doing stuff, right? Like, I'm not adverse to any of that. And, you know, there's a lot of implications with being involved with Saudi Arabia. But one way or another, as I said, the global politic and the global business is changing. And that's the direction it is going in. And weirdly enough, cricket being in the UAE is, you know, and the ICC is way ahead of the curve on compared to a lot of other sports, right? Like, you know, I don't know if we'll have an NBA team in Dubai, but there seems to be a lot of hype about basketball and Dubai at the moment. And I think Boston played Denver. So the two recent champions went up against each other, you know, not this year, the year before, in Dubai for a warm-up game. Like,
wow,
guys, this is changing.
Yeah.
And it's changing really, really quickly. Mm. And though that part of the world, you know, that whole area has a lot of natural resources and they're cashing in. And so they're coming to cricket as much as they're coming to everything else. Like, I'm not saying was it Oman that gave, who gave Donald Trump a plane last year or the year before? Like,
oh, okay. Like, that happened.
It was someone gave him like a plane, right?
Okay. So Oman, if they did give Donald Trump a plane, they didn't have enough money to give to their cricketers. That also happened this year.
Oh my God. I forgot about that. Someone from Oman cricket wanted to clear the air, and I was trying to talk to the players. I could never quite get to the bottom of what happened, but yeah, they Oman shit the bed a bit there.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, look, all of these things are changing rapidly, and I feel that if not soon, then eventually there will be an entry of Saudi Arabia into cricket in some sort of context. And you have to remember that there's a lot of diaspora, Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, even Sri Lankans living in Saudi Arabia.
Which That's they cracking. Have, again, they probably haven't cashed in on yet, right? In a way that Dubai has, and Oman and some of those other countries up, you know, Kuwait. Kuwait's got a good cricket team, right? Like, you know, there's some other places that are starting cash in on that. So I think that's also part of it, right?
Absolutely. And I feel like it's only a matter of time. Even if it's not at a major scale, there will be something. There will be some shit T20 league at the very least that Saudi Arabia will be running. But given the scale of, you know, funds that they have, it could be massive. It could be in partnership with one of the big boys. Could be a Champions League sort of arrangement. Who doesn't want to see Champions League T20 cricket return, right? Now that you've got all of these franchise leagues, it would make perfect sense. But anyway, one last thing that we need to discuss, and it's also related to the commerce side of cricket, is that there was a bit of a tussle between the ICC and the Jio Star Group. Of course, those two companies, they merged, Jio and Star. And
I thought you were going to say the ICC and Jio merged, which also is kind of true.
Yeah, I mean, they did kind of exchange employees, I suppose. But yeah, so clearly the broadcasters, they realized that they've overpaid for the rights. And I feel like this was a trailer that we just saw towards the end of 2025, and eventually the next set of rights won't be sold for as much, and that's going to impact cricket a lot because, you know, big countries like India will survive, but, you know, the lesser endowed cricket boards, they're already heavily dependent on ICC funding. If that funding decreases, then all that talk of growing the game kind of goes into the mud.
I've been following this for a long time in cricket and in other sports. Quite often, at some stage during the rights, both sides kind of admit there was an overpay, right? No one's doubting that, but that's Jio's fault, right? Like, they made the bid. It was, I think, within the industry. This is my understanding of having talked to a couple of people within the industry. They were like, yeah, it's an overpay. Mm. We know it's an overpay. And they tried to get out of it. Generally, though, when the next rights come up, they don't become cheaper.
Mm.
And there's another overpay.
Fascinating.
Almost all sports rights seem to be overpays.
Mm.
And then we quite often get this thing. Do you remember Channel 7 tried to sue Cricket Australia?
Okay. Tell me more.
Right? Yeah. So that was, what, 3 or 4 years back, I think, now? I know there are other boards who have suddenly received calls from executives going, can we renegotiate? And the board's like, well, no. And they're like, well, we may not bid next time. And they're like, okay, that's fair enough. But you bid this amount. And this is what we told you was going to happen. It's a very common thing. So I don't want people to panic too much because this is now, it seems like almost everyone buys rights to sport and then almost automatically goes, why do we pay that much? Mm. We're never going to make this money back, right? Also, I think in Jio's case, because of the merger, also because this is my understanding that, like, originally a lot of it was about the mobile phone coverage, right? you know, trying to make sure they were, and now they've, I would assume there's a bit of a saturation of the mobile phones, and maybe they're like, it's, we're not reaching any extra people. So I don't want anyone to panic on that side. The interesting thing is that the Jio has a political, not political, like a personnel issue within the ICC, in that their former employee is involved.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge conflict of interest, and that's Cricket's fault. Cricket allowed this to happen, mm-hmm. and now is looking at it going, oh, wait, what have we done?
Yeah.
Cricket boards have to be smarter, and they are getting run over by very smart people at times in this situation. But it's also something that we need to be prepared for, that the issue at the moment is that unless you have two or three strong bidders, there could be a bit of a dip. And I don't mean a dip as in the next rights package will be less, because I don't think that's the case. But they may not grow by the same amount.
True.
And the reason they won't, you can only do that. You know, England cricket has had a bit of an issue because BBC and TNT won't go for the rights. And so Sky's kind of, well, not that, won't go for the rights with big deals. Mm. And so Sky's kind of on their own. And so Sky can kind of just pay what they want to pay.
Yep.
Right? And so, you know, you had that issue in Australia a couple of years ago where Channel 9, Channel 10, Channel 7 and Foxtel all wanted the rights at the same time. Mm. That's the dream.
Yeah.
Right? The dream.
Do we rule out Netflix and Amazon at this point? They should realize the market.
No, but whether they want to give enough money that there'll be continual, you want them to give enough money that it's continual overpay. I know that sounds bad, but kind of that's what you want. So you don't, the problem from what I understand of the American companies, you know, Amazon, Netflix, all those sorts of ones, is that they kind of went, wait a minute, we think it's worth this much and Jio think it's worth this much. Well, it's clearly not worth that much. Right?
Yeah.
You want it to be so there's a little bit outbidding each other and that pushes it ahead. I think the fact that there are American companies that are more interested in cricket now will probably keep that. And talking about what, to lead on from the last conversation, what about DAZN?
Yeah.
The Saudi-backed company who's buying a lot of stuff as well. If you can get Netflix, Amazon, DAZN, and a major Indian companies involved, maybe you could keep the gravy train going. Hmm. But yeah, maybe we won't continue with the growth that we've seen over the last couple of years. But it's very common. The thing is that I've seen this before. One of the most famous ones was the early days of TalkSport, where they paid a bunch for a radio rights, right? Without really factoring in how many people would be listening kind of overnight to the Ashes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they were desperate to have the Ashes. And I know this sounds silly, but this still happens because people are like, well, we've got all this money. We have to spend it. Oh, we have to get this thing. And then they get it and they go, oh, we've got this tournament, but actually that's not going to work for our audience. That people don't always work back from that because they're trying to beat all these other companies.
Yeah.
So it doesn't always, I would love to say that everyone involved is always a genius, but there has been overpays and there has been issues, but a lot of it's just to do with the market, right? Like, you know, it's one of the big problems in South Africa, right? They don't have two people bidding the rights up.
Yeah.
It's another issue in New Zealand. Some of the reasons these boards don't make as much money is because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm. Whereas in Australia, you can keep pushing it because there's multiple people who want to show it. And they're just, if you don't have two or three companies, you would have seen this in Pakistan at times. You don't have three companies with money that all want it at the same time, sometimes the price stagnates a little bit.
In Pakistan, the state often just buys the right and national television will show it.
You see what I'm saying?
That happens. But I feel like, you know, what people might not understand is ultimately it's just a battle of businessmen. And this in particular,
yes,
what we've seen is a battle of Indian businessmen, because on one hand, you have Jio who have incurred losses and the Ambanis are up top. On the other side, you've got the ICC who have made profits with Jay Shah over there. And then Sanjay Gupta, the elephant in the room, first worked for Jio Star, and now he works at the ICC. So there's a lot of
it doesn't matter where, in which direction you go in the cricket at the moment. Most of the conversations when you talk about this stuff lead you out of cricket again. They are far bigger things. And if you go back to our coverage in Saudi Arabia, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Olympics. We're talking about geopolitical, things. Trump and Modi's relationship was brought up sometimes when I was talking about these things. Like, they are so far and beyond just cricket at the moment, because cricket is actually quite profitable and quite important and quite, you know, a big part of so many people's lives, that it's unfortunately rubbing into things in the old way. And it's not that this has never happened. Bayram can go into the story about, was it Roosevelt?
Yeah, it was. No, it was Eisenhower or Roosevelt?
Eisenhower, Eisenhower. Yeah. Eisenhower changed Pakistani cricket pitches forever.
Yep.
The truth is that, you know, it because it's so important to the subcontinent, and because the subcontinent is so big.
It is the market, right? You look at India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and that's what, 92%, I would assume, of the cricket market?
Okay, so let's say you and I, I'm trying to think, let's say you and I came up with a new dating app tomorrow, right?
Okay.
And it's a successful app in some other regions, and we want to go to the subcontinental market. Right. What's the quickest way to get to right across the subcontinental market?
Cricket.
Right. And people, and that means that the geopolitics understand this. And as you said, the billion-dollar business people understand this and everything else. That's where we are. It's a fascinating time for cricket because we're going through our own internal struggles and there's a lot of external pressures as well. And that, Bayram, was 2025.
It was, but just to cap the show
there?
Off.
See what I did there? I just brought it back.
I did kind of like how you went full circle over there, literally. But, you know, for us as well, we've gone into 2026 with Combox. I suppose we should talk about that a little. Good Areas Live was fun. It still technically exists, but it's rebranded and we're scaling up and we're excited to have you guys all on board. Lots of fun stuff in store. So, yeah, I hope you loved what we did last year. Of course, Robbie came on board, as did Deepak. We got the Kimapa show. Crick Picks grew stronger and stronger. And all of our lives and other shows got lots of hits. It was a successful year for us, which is thanks to all of you. But now we're headed into more serious territory. And that's exciting, Jared.
Yeah. You know, Combox is... It's not just a rebrand and bringing Robbie and Deepak in.
Yeah.
You'll start to see other faces coming in. We have talked to some of the most serious people in cricket about coming on board. We have some partnerships involved that are really, really exciting. We've got some whole ideas of how to cover cricket that have never been used before. There's a lot coming up, and Combox is a very big project that we're all very excited about. But there's nothing really disappearing, I think, from what we're doing. It's, you know, there's a couple of shows that are changing where they usually go. Like, there are more of my lives and chats like this now that will be on our main channel, which we didn't always have before. So, you know, there's some changes from that perspective. But yeah, overall, we're trying to use the spirit of Good Areas and then sort of advance that to involve some other great writers, analysts, former players, current players have reached out as well. You know, it's really exciting for us to be able to do that sort of stuff. And also knowing that we already know all this stuff works because it's worked with you guys.
Yeah. And our ambition is to change cricket media forever. And if not, we'll die trying. So stay with us
Pretty
in 2026.
Much.
We'll do a rewind at the
where
end.
Where we may die trying. Yeah. Oh, no, wait.
It might actually happen. But anyway, if you guys keep up all of this love and support that you show us, I'm sure that we'll be successful. So here it is. A toast to 2025. I'll do it with this pet monkey or stuffed monkey. And hopefully 2026 will be even better. There we go. All right. Have a good one, guys. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you soon enough. Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.